This is In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. History is all around us. Okay, obviously that's an aphorism. History is inescapable, and so of course it is all around us. You are the embodiment of the ancestors who came before you. Time marches on, and even that unfinished coffee on the windowsill is, you know, an example of very recent history. But I do a lot of walking around this city of ours, and what I mean by the statement, history is all around us, is that very often it's impossible, when coming across a structure, or a statue, or pathway, or building, or even a really old tree, to not be drawn into the past, or at least to be drawn into wondering about the past. A stand of four really tall cottonwoods west of Liberty Park in front of a one-story brick house does this to me all the time. I think, I'd love to know who planted those, and if they ever knew that those trees would be that tall, and with somebody's Subaru Outback carefully squeezed in between two trunks. Of course, whoever planted those trees probably wasn't able to predict the Subaru Outback. One person who I know shares this same obsession is Rachel Quist. We've had her on the show before. Rachel is an archaeologist by training, but as a passion project on the side, she runs an Instagram account and website called Rachel's SLC History that basically does try to satisfy her own curiosity about the past that is visible in the present world. This week, she highlighted the Brutalist-style structure on the corner of 2nd South and 2nd East that is soon to be undergoing conversion into, what else, apartments. Though apparently they'll be using the existing structure to do that. The building is this white block of a thing. It was entirely windowless in its first iteration, but with later additions that did include some outside lighting. To get the full rundown, head on over to slchistory.org. Anyway, Rachel's research revealed that the building was constructed to house a data processing center and business office for Mountain Bell Telephone, part of the Bell System phone monopoly that existed all over the country until its antitrust breakup in 1983. Shorthand, Bell System was called Ma Bell.
I had a couple of customers say, give me to a female operator because she knows how to handle a call. I said, I am fully trained and I know how to handle your call. Now, what is it you want? And then sometimes they would calm down and sometimes they'd hang up.
That's Richard Goers, who worked as a Bell System telephone switchboard operator in downtown Salt Lake City in the early 1970s, and who went on to hold other jobs with the phone company for the next three decades. When he worked as a switchboard operator, he was, by his reckoning, the only man on the job in his office. Though, he says he had a struggle getting the job.
I applied with the telephone company. I always wanted to be a phone operator because those long-distance cord boards really fascinated me. So as I applied, they said, well, you have a bachelor's degree. You're way overqualified to be a telephone operator. I said, that's nonsense. I said, if this is the reason that you don't want to hire me, I said, I will sue you. And so then they hired me.
The story that Rachel Quist published this week about the old Mountain Bell office building brought Richard Goers to mind. Richard is my neighbor, and occasionally I've heard from him little tidbits about what it was like to work on the switchboard. Tidbits that were always fascinating to me, and that's because it's a job that is just entirely gone. And so there's that embodiment of history again. By the way, a Dutchman by birth, Richard ended up in Utah in the 1960s by a simple twist of fate and ended up staying.
I came to the United States many, many years ago. It was in 1963. First it was in 1962 when the World's Fair was on. And it so happened I stayed with a Mormon family in Arlington, Virginia, who had a missionary in my hometown in Holland. And so the lady of the house at the time asked me, why are you not in college? And I said, because college is expensive in Holland and we can't afford it. And she said, I will talk to my husband. So when her husband came home, she said to him, we are going to put this young man through college, aren't we, honey? And he said, of course. And so this is how I, you know, became a student at Brigham Young University. I studied foreign languages, both for a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. And I taught there for a couple of years also when I was working on the degree.
I should say that Richard Gowers didn't work in that Mountain Bell building featured in Rachel's SLC history this week. Instead, he worked just down the road in the old Salt Lake Telegraph and Telephone building on the corner of First South and State Street. The building's still there and has its own unique history, as does that particular spot in the city. Originally, the parcel housed the pioneer Salt Lake Theater, built in 1862. But that's a tale for another episode. Today, when you want to call somebody, assuming you do, there are a lot of people who only want to communicate by text, but anyway, if you want to make a call, you do that without thinking, using the phone in your pocket. When Richard Gowers was a switchboard operator in downtown Salt Lake City in the early 70s, the process was quite a bit different.
We were properly trained, of course, and we were trained in how to handle local calls, emergency calls, long-distance calls, person-to-person, international, the whole bit. And so we had a system there that every call was recorded on an IBM card. So when a light would come on the switchboard, you know, we'd plug in and we'd say, operator, and then the person would say, I want to make a person-to-person call to so-and-so, and we'd write all this information down with a number two pencil on an IBM card. And then we had to fill in the numbers that we were going to call on the little oval spaces, and we were not to go beyond or, you know, we had to fully fill them. And then when we had all that information, we'd say, okay, hang on a moment. And then we'd take the other cord and plug it into a trunk line, and then we would dial the number. And then as soon as the conversation would start, we would say to the customer, okay, they're online, go ahead. And we'd close the key, because then we would be out of the conversation. We'd stick the IBM card into a clock and pull the handle, and then an actual clock stamp would be on the bottom of the IBM card to show at what time the conversation started. And then when the conversation would end, the little lights on the switchboard would come on, we'd pull up the ticket, stick it in the clock, and pull the handle again, and then it would show the time when the conversation ended. So in case people said, I want time and charges, we would note that, of course, on the ticket, and then we would figure out how many minutes they had spoken, and if we didn't know the rate, we had to call a route and rate operator to say, hey, how much is a call to so-and-so number from so-and-so number? And she would say, oh, that'll be $1.35 for the first minute. And then we'd have to figure out how much it was. We'd call the customer back and say, your call was so many minutes and it cost you so much money. That's how it worked.
In addition to working at the Bell switchboard in Salt Lake for a time, Richard worked as a switchboard operator in Provo, where he frequently worked the night shift.
Yeah, there weren't very many calls. I remember one funny one. I handled phone calls to Mexico because I speak Spanish. And so I had a call that came in at about 11:30 at night. And I connected the call, and it was to the Colonia Juarez in Mexico. So I had to first call the city of Juarez, and then that operator would connect me to Colonia Juarez. And so then, you know, that was the end of the call, and then the customer could talk. Then at 12 o'clock, I noticed all of a sudden both lights came on. No, one light came on, and so that meant that one person had disconnected and the other not. So I went into the call and said, what happened? And the lady said, well, I was disconnected. I said, okay, one moment, I'll reconnect you. So I go to the city of Juarez, and I said, operator, we were disconnected to Colonia Juarez. She said, you need to know, in Colonia Juarez, they go home at midnight and they pull all the plugs out. I said, okay, fine. So the customer heard this, and then I told her, I said, I'm sorry, but they've gone home. Call back tomorrow. That's how it was.
That's great. The phones would be disconnected at midnight. I mean, isn't Colonia Juarez am I right that it's a polygamous community?
Yes, it is. Okay. Oh, yes.
Again, sometimes the phones just couldn't be answered. People weren't constantly reachable the way that they are often expected to be today. There are a lot of internet memes circulating about kids growing up these days who will never know the joy of being unfindable, disconnected, hidden from the authority figures in their lives. But I digress. I loved interviewing Richard about his time on the switchboard because it was this snapshot in the development of technology. And it was a job that afforded operators like Richard a unique window onto history. For example, on November 24th, 1971, a Saturday, Richard was working the night shift, a generally really sleepy shift on the job. But then some big news broke, and it was so fascinating that people wanted to talk about it with their friends and relatives. So they picked up the phone.
I do remember, though, one night, it was very, very busy. That switchboard lit up, and we didn't have enough people to answer the calls. And it was when that airplane came over, when the guy jumped out with all the money. Remember? It was
D.B. Cooper.
Yes. Uh-huh. And so even the chief operator called us late at night, you know, and said, how are you handling this situation? I said, well, we've had lots and lots of calls. We couldn't really handle it all at the same time, but we did. Mm-hmm. And people were just asking, oh, have you heard? You know, what's going on? Because we as operators were supposed to know everything. It was very interesting. Yeah, but I worked that night.
The D.B. Cooper heist is also a story for another podcast. If you don't know it, it's a fascinating true crime tale about a hijacking, a briefcase filled with cash, and a man parachuting into infamy, never to be seen again. In the 1980s and 90s, there was even a bar here in Salt Lake City called D.B. Cooper's. Anyway, Google it. Great story. In 1971, if you dialed the operator from a payphone in Utah to make a collect call, you might get Richard Goers on the other end of the line. Payphones are another nearly bygone contraption that are great for lore. I mean, Clark Kent even changed into Superman inside of a phone booth.
Up in the sky, look!
It's a bird!
It's a plane! It's Superman!
But a lot of people have payphone stories. A friend of mine would check in with her family by gaming the automated collect call feature of payphones in the 1990s. On road trips, she'd make a collect call, and when the automated prompt asked for her name, she'd say, "Made it safe to Denver." Or, "I'm in Elko, and all's well." On the other end of the line, a robotic operator would say to her mom, "Would you like to accept a collect call from?" And then her message would play, "Made it safe to Denver." Her mom would get her daughter's message, but she'd reject the call and the charges. But my neighbor Richard Goer's time was before that kind of automation. So again, you'd pick up the payphone to make a call, even a paid call, and you'd get him.
Okay, we knew when a person was calling from a payphone because the fourth number was always a 9. That changed later on. Sometimes it was a different number also, but in most cases it was a 9. So when a person from a payphone would call and say, "I need to make a station-to-station call to California," and any place in California was at the time $1.35 for the first 3 minutes. So we would take all the information down on the infamous IBM card, and then you could ask, "Do you have the money ready?" And most people did. So after we established a call on a regular payphone, we would ask for the money first. We would not collect it, but we would ask them to dump the money in. And so we'd say, "Please deposit $1.35. So they would deposit a quarter. And in my ear, I would hear dong. That was the quarter. And I would write that down on my IBM card. Another dong, so that was 2. And then another one, so that was $1. And then they'd hit it again. That was 5 quarters. And then the dime was ding, ding. And then a nickel was 1 ding. And then after we added up, they said, "Okay, let me call the number for you." So we would put the plug in, we dialed the number, and then the person would come online. And we wouldn't even announce the call because it was a station-to-station call. And we'd close the key, and then we would collect the money. We'd press the button that said collect, and we'd collect the $1.35. And then the person at the payphone could hear that these coins would go into a particular box that's sitting in the payphone itself. Now, if the number did not answer, and of course we would be online as long as the phone was not answered, then we would say to the customer, "I'm sorry, but there's no answer. Let me return the money to you." And then I would press the button that said, you know, "Return." And then that money would roll back into the slot and the customer would pick up the money and put it in their pocket.
I think the suspicion from people was always that switchboard operators were listening in, that they didn't hang up, that they were there to just like hear what was going on in your world. Was that something that actually happened?
We in Provo, they used to have that every position, you know, could listen in on calls, and then an installer came and disconnected all that except for the position that was open at night. We actually had two positions, but one of the two positions, and we knew which one it was, we could actually listen in on calls. So sometimes late at night, when stuff got boring and people were still talking, you could listen in if you wanted to.
There's all sorts of ways that a switchboard operator would be read in on things that nobody else would know about. You knew a lot of secrets, I guess, is sort of what.
Oh yes, definitely yes. One time, I was pulled off the switchboard by a supervisor. I had a call, and it was from a woman who was having an affair with somebody else, and all the operators knew about it except me because I was new. And so the person on the other end asked, it was a woman, you know, well, who was calling? And the woman on the other end was asking actually for her husband, and I mentioned her name. And oh my goodness, that was a no-no. Yes, and so then they told me the secret of this. Well, of course, I couldn't know what this was all about. Yes, but it did happen.
I wonder if that particular affair came to an end right then and there.
It could have been, yes. There's so much history, and I love to look at all these pictures, you know, because you see some of these women, how they were dressed all in black. In fact, I was told in Provo that there was a dress code for the women. I said, I'm not a woman. And they said, you are not allowed to wear blue jeans. I said, why? Nobody sees me. And so one time I wore my blue jeans, you know, I guess it was probably laundry day or whatever, and I was pulled off the switchboard. And the supervisor said, you are not allowed to wear blue jeans. I said, you want me to drop them? And she said, oh, Richard. Yes. And then another time I had a blue shirt on that looked like denim, but it was cotton. And the one of the supervisors came and she grabbed my shirt between her fingers and she was feeling it. And she said, is this denim? I said, you are a woman. You should know. And that was the end of the conversation. But that's how picky and, you know, a little narrow-minded it was. But that was Provo. The universities usually had their own switchboard. BYU had their own switchboard. It was an old cordboard. I remember Sears in the very tower, you know, the Sears store that's closed now on 754 South State Street. Yeah. On the top, they had a switchboard. And University of Utah has a switchboard. All cord boards, yes.
Just to divvy it out to the different departments, different play, they had, you know, what are you trying to get through to engineering? And then you would put them through to engineering. Or
yeah, it was all the same. And then, you know, the PBX, you know, was the little switchboard, that smaller company. I had one here in my house one time because there was a company, a lumber company here in Salt Lake that did away with what was called Ketchum's. They're non-existent anymore now. And they went to another company and decided to do away with the switchboard. And we as installers, we were allowed to buy the old switchboard, but we usually had to take them to a yard where they would smash the insides out so we couldn't use it anymore. I had the one that really worked. And I hooked it up to my house here one time and had kids play with it. It was fun. Then all my extensions in the house, you know, were connected to that board. I had only one trunk incoming, but then you could connect one extension to another by means of that cord board. Yeah, PBX, that word actually means private branch exchange.
And I think of it as audio cables, essentially.
Yeah, in a way it is. Yeah. Yes. But they were all connected with wires. There was no wireless connection at all. It all had to be wired. If a company wanted to have an extra extension tied to their switchboard, we had to run a wire from that location to the switchboard. Yes, and if they needed some extra trunks, then we needed sometimes, you know, get an extra cable pair that would be hooked up to that switchboard so that they would have more lines incoming. A lot of that, of course, has changed now. Yeah, when you look at it, you think, oh my goodness, that was old-fashioned. In fact, I was told before I left that industry that if nowadays we still had cord boards to have the whole country connected, international, whatever, we would need every woman and every child in this nation to operate switchboards. That's how far we've gone.
Again, that's Richard Goers. He worked as a switchboard operator for the Bell system here in Salt Lake City. The local version of that telephone monopoly was called Mountain Bell. After his time on the switchboard, which actually was pretty short, maybe just a year and a bit, Richard went on to work for a few decades after that in various positions as an installer, even as a wire repairman, for the successive companies here in Utah that came after the Ma Bell monopoly was broken up. And Richard, thanks very much for the tour of a bygone job and a portrait of a place in time. I should also say thanks to Rachel Quist from Rachel's SLC History for, well, all the historical digging that she does. Check her out on Instagram or at slchistory.org if you haven't already. And finally, are you somebody who held a job that, you know, doesn't exist anymore and with stories to tell? I'd love to hear about it. Drop me a line, email comments@kcpw.org. That does it for In the Hive from KCPW, a listener-supported, entirely independent, local public radio resource. Find podcasts and more over at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. A young Politico's version of Both Sides of the Aisle is coming up next.
If you knew how to produce a certain amount of decibels, then you would disconnect a call. Yes, if you stood next to a person who was talking on the phone and you could produce that sound, I forgot what it was. I can't remember how many decibels it was, but we tried it out and it actually worked. Wow. Yeah, one of our colleagues knew how to do it and it was fun.
Wow.
Yes.
Hello? Hello, Dimitri. Listen, I can't hear too well. Do you suppose you could turn the music down just a little? Oh, that's much better. Yes. Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine.